What is the most important e-discovery issue today?
Cost control?
Technology-assisted review?
Information management?
Preservation?
From the latest cases to the newest technologies.
Our goal is to expose legal professionals to the most important e-discovery trends
with the brightest e-discovery experts.
Rulemaking,
predictive coding,
litigation hold,
proportionality,
document review,
social media,
efficiency,
ethics,
cooperation.
Welcome to the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track, an e-discovery software and service provider. You are listening to the Legal Talk Network.
Hi, I'm Michelle Lang, and welcome to the ESI Report. Today we are talking EDA and PC, early data assessment and predictive coding. Most e-discovery practitioners have developed an understanding of these methods to reduce discovery data and form a discovery production. However, the synergies that can be gained from marrying these two seemingly independent concepts have been relatively unexplored. Today, Anthony Diana from Mayer Brown and Jonathan Sachs from Kroll On Track are here with me to peel back the layers on predictive coding and test the line in the sand that currently isolates predictive coding from traditional early data assessment tools in the minds of most e-discovery teams. Anthony Diana is a partner at Mayer Brown, where he co-leads the Electronic Discovery and Records Management Group. Jonathan Sachs leverages over 16 years of experience consulting and practicing at the intersection of law and technology and is a senior account executive at Kroll On Track. Hi, Anthony and Jonathan. So happy you could join me today.
Thrilled to be here.
Thanks, Michelle. Thanks for inviting me today.
So let's go ahead and get started. I think we need, first of all, a no-frills crash course into early data analysis and why attorneys still find value in analyzing data sets at the onset of a manner. Anthony, do you want to get us started and kick it off?
Sure. I think one of the critical components of looking at data early is for budgeting purposes as well as planning purposes. I think, you know, one of the things that we've seen is there is a tremendous amount of benefit of getting a sense of the data so that we can plan accordingly. And that includes, you know, figuring out how much data do we think we're actually going to end up having to review and produce. And that helps certainly with budgeting, but also the types of data that we're seeing from looking at an early data assessment. Those types of data can help inform not only the case team in terms of what are the legal issues that they're seeing in the documents, but also help in negotiations with the plaintiffs or government regulators who are making requests, or even when you're going in front of a court, because now you can have actual facts and figures that you can go in front of a court or the other side and say, this is what we're seeing, and this is why, and whatever position you're going to take, whether that's these are the number of custodians that we think we need to, or key players that we need to focus on. These are the types of search terms that we want to use because they've been tested. You know, these are the concepts that we're seeing. These are the subject matters. So all of that is very helpful in sort of early on in the case.
And so, Jonathan, how does everything Anthony just talked about sync up with predictive coding? If I understand it correctly, predictive coding is mostly seen as a review and production tool and is often standalone from the EDA process.
I think that that is how it's been perceived in the past, Michelle, but I think it's actually being perceived differently today. So if we really look at this and you look at the traditional flow of discovery, you start with collection and you move into what is commonly known as the EDA portion of discovery. And that's where you're going to perform some of your early data assessment or your early data analysis, where you might be looking at filter terms. You might be looking at how search is performed. You might leverage clustering of data and of documents. You might even do some testing and some QC. But what happens today to a degree, but happened in the past, is you would then have to move out of the EDA and move into your review platform, which would require processing of the data. It would require you to ensure that the grouping that you had done or any tagging that you had done in the early data assessment portion of the tool was moved into the review platform. You had to worry about and ensure that the productions that you were intending to make, the format of production that either you've decided you'd produce in or that you frankly have agreed to produce in, can be done in your review platform. And then you got into the document review stage, where traditionally, the predictive coding would take place. But what would happen is you would then do some of the same searching you might have done in your EDA phase. You might do some of the similar tagging. You could do, of course, the other parts of a doc review like redaction, privilege, log, workflow, and routing. And then you'd move to production. But there's a lot of overlap in that traditional way of looking at EDA, and in some cases, some real inefficiencies. So I think what we're seeing today, and what I think is what we'll see in the future, is EDA and review involving predictive coding together. In essence, going from collection to production with one step in the middle or one process in the middle, and that's when you're actually analyzing and reviewing the data, leveraging early data assessment or analysis, as well as predictive coding from the initial stages when you're doing an assessment of what is this case about, who are my key custodians, all the way through to the what is relevant, what's not relevant, what's privileged, so that you're not going through some of the same data jockeying that you might have done in the past.
So Anthony, talk to me a little bit about what features or components of predictive coding lend themselves to analysis, and specifically analysis that can occur early on in a case.
Yeah, well, I think one of the true advantages of the use of predictive coding is understanding the case and the documents sooner. And that happens in several different steps. One, when you're doing the sampling or you're creating the seed set, you're having senior attorneys look at documents and making decisions early on, and that's going to be extrapolated across a larger population. And then what's being pulled in terms of prioritization are the documents that are most likely to be similar to what that senior attorney made the decision on, which is this is responsive, this is what's not responsive, but this is what's responsive. So having that ability to do that helps in terms of, you know, having the senior attorneys and frankly the lawyers as a whole look at documents that are most likely to be responsive to a case or important to a case earlier in the process. And I think that's critical. Again, a lot of things I talked about before, if you're getting that early on and you're seeing what's responsive early on, you have a better sense of how many documents you're going to end up producing at the end. What are the issues that you're going to have? You may find that a lot of them are privileged based on this, or you can find out there's a lot of redactions that need to be done. There's lots of things as you're looking at the data at a very high level where you're saying, okay, here using predictive coding, this is a percentage that is a very high number of documents, and you're seeing them early on, you have a better sense of going to the other side and saying, look, here's an issue that I have, or to the client and having them involved and having them understand that there could be, you know, impacts on the budget, could be an impact on the timeline that you want to notify the court about. So there's lots of things that can happen early on, and using predictive coding and really getting in terms of prioritization or a categorization so you have a sense of the documents that are being given a score and a high score for responsiveness or a high score because it's likely to be privileged. All of that is data that you can use to help for planning purposes as well as for, what I would say, advocacy purposes with the other side or for the court.
Jonathan, do you have anything else to add here, and specifically maybe some concluding marks on the blurred line between EDA and PC as we wrap it?
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. Predictive coding has its place in EDA. And Anthony hit on a number of the ways it can be beneficial early on. You know, I think the things that you need to be really mindful of, though, when you think about EDA, you think about keywords and keywords used for filtering. When you talk about predictive coding, you're really talking about the technology and the training that's going to go into the document sets. So in EDA, if you're going to go ahead and you're going to be culling aggressively with keywords, you need to be cognizant of the fact that it will have an impact on training that you're going to be doing in your predictive coding. I think that any search strategy that you're going to be using, whether it's the EDA or predictive coding, is going to have to be designed according to the matter at hand. What is the client trying to achieve? What is the obligation that's owed to the other side in the course of the matter? And then defensibility. Whether you're leveraging the EDA technologies of old or you're leveraging predictive coding, what you do, how you do it, expect that you're going to have to defend both of those. And you want to make sure that you're in the best position to both advocate on behalf of your client, like Anthony does, but also make sure that the representations you're making to the court are accurate and defensible.
Well, it's a fascinating topic, and I thank you, Anthony and Jonathan, both. You know, this topic is one that's very consistent with the themes that we have been blogging about at theediscoveryblog.com. So be sure to check that out. Before I let both of you go, Anthony and Jonathan, we like ESI report guests to have a little bit of fun before they leave. eDiscovery doesn't have to be serious all of the time. Are you up for a little bit of an eDiscovery numbers guessing game?
Sure.
Absolutely.
All right. So I'm going to ask you a question, and this game ties in with some very interesting benchmarks that Kroll on Track recently released on ediscovery.com. They're calling these benchmarks the Pulse, which is a set of real-time trended data to show trends in the eDiscovery market, and it's really an aggregation and normalization of thousands of matters that Kroll on Track has handled without divulging any client-specific data. So I'm going to give you a bit of information and see if you can guess which pulse benchmark that data ties to. Sound like a plan?
Sure.
All right. So here's question number one. This form of ESI accounts for 66% of data processed in 2012. So if for matters in 2012, 66% of the data processed in those matters was what type of data?
Well, if it was my IT department answering this question, I think I'd know what it was. I tend to only communicate these days by email and don't know the last time I actually sent anything typed up and in an envelope that was business related. So since I keep maxing out my mailbox limits, I'm going to go with email. Even though I have a lot of other types of documents and data, I'm going email.
I agree with that. I think in part that's reflective not only what the data that's being created, but probably more so the data that's being requested. I think plaintiffs still are focused on email because they still view that as a source, and regulators, the source of where the hot documents are going to be. But I think one of the other things you're seeing is that, at least I'm seeing, is a lot of people are not even asking for sort of the loose files because, and I've taken this position that we'll give you the email because most of the loose files are going to be attachments to emails anyway. So I'm going to go with email as well.
You guys are dead on. It's exactly right. When it comes to eDiscovery document review, email is where it's at. And it has been a steady trend that more than half of review databases are composed of email. Question number two. On average, what have organizations done with approximately 25% of the data they've reviewed over the last 5 years?
What have they done with it? This is Anthony. 25% of the data they've reviewed, I would probably say, at least the metrics that I've seen, that's not a bad percentage of produced, but that's probably, yeah, I think it's probably what they've actually produced. 25%, that's usually after search terms, because search terms we use are so bad that they're not exactly precise, so we end up reviewing still a lot of data. So probably 25% of reviewed is probably what's been produced.
Jonathan, I'll let him go with that one and give you the next one because Anthony's right on. This pulse trend suggests that the ratio of pages reviewed to pages produced remains about 1 in 4. So most parties are producing about 25% of the pages they load for review.
And that's just awful.
There's definitely room for improvement. So let's go ahead and we'll ask the last pulse benchmark question. This metric has been in sharp decline since 2008. Fortunately, filtering tools have enabled reviewers to cut down this number to around 20 per case. Jonathan, any guess on what 20 per case is for the 2012 cases?
Well, I'm going to tell you that it's not gigabytes of data because we're certainly seeing more and more data, although I think we're getting better at focusing on what kind of data needs to be collected and reviewed. So if it's not going to be data, then I'm more inclined to say that it's probably going to be the people that are involved in those matters. So I'm going to go with custodians as my last and final answer.
Last and final answer is correct, Jonathan. It is the number of custodians, which is approximately about 20 per case, which is less than half of those collected in 2008. If you look at this trend, it is in sharp decline over the last 5 years. And I think that's a testament to the tools and the negotiating and the process and just everybody getting smarter about eDiscovery.
And that's still way too high. 20 is ridiculous.
You know, there's room for improvement. I look forward to seeing the 2000 metrics, which should be released on eDiscovery.com, I would bet, in January.
Oh, absolutely.
Well, guys, that was fun. That's all I have. It just goes to show that two lawyers are not afraid to play with numbers, so I appreciate it. Thank you guys for joining me.
Thank you. It was fun.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. I enjoyed the conversation.
And thanks, everybody, for listening. This was another great edition of the ESI Report. If you want to see the presentation that Jonathan and Anthony put together, rather than just hearing it, feel free to download a webinar that they presented on the very same topic on November 20th. It's available on ediscovery.com under Resources. If you click through, you'll find it. Until next time, I'm Michelle Lang, saying thanks for tuning in.
This was another edition of the ESI Report, sponsored by Kroll On Track. Be sure to follow Kroll On Track on Facebook and Twitter, or learn more about Kroll On Track software and services at www.krolontrack.com. Thanks for listening to the ESI Report, produced by the broadcast professionals at Legal Talk Network. Join Michelle Lang for her next podcast on the latest e-discovery trends. Subscribe to the RSS feed on LegalTalkNetwork.com or in iTunes. The views expressed by the participants of this program are their own and do not represent the views of, nor are they endorsed by, Legal Talk Network, its officers, directors, employees, agents, representatives, shareholders, and subsidiaries. None of the content should be considered legal advice. As always, consult a lawyer.